Hello and welcome to the Weekly Stuff Podcast with Jonathan Lack.
And Sean Chapman.
We are here, as always, to talk about stuff. This week on the show, we're going to do two shows.
Yes, we are.
Because we missed a week last week. Sean will tell you all about that.
Uh-huh.
It's actually a more interesting story than you were just busy.
More happened.
Yeah.
More happened.
We'll talk about that in a minute. But what we're doing, we're kind of splitting these two episodes thematically. Today on episode 213, we're going to go over all of the news from the past 2 weeks, which was super eventful just in terms of the stuff we talk about, entertainment news and that sort of stuff, on top of two more weeks of a flood of sexual assault allegations against people in entertainment, media, and politics that I would feel remiss not to talk about.
Yeah, especially because over the past couple of weeks, when these things started sort of bubbling up, we talked about them then. Yeah, it would feel weird not to talk about it now.
Yeah, and it feels like, I mean, like, Kevin Spacey, that feels like an age ago. That was in the gap since the last episode.
Yeah.
And we need to address these things, so we will talk about all of that. That'll be today's show, will be news-related stuff and analysis. And on the next episode, which will be Wednesday or Thursday, I haven't decided when I'll put it out, we will be reviewing Thor Ragnarok, Sonic Forces, more on Mario Odyssey, more on Wolfenstein 2,
yeah.
All of that review stuff. And then on our third show of the week, we're going to do an in-depth track-by-track analysis of the new Taylor Swift album, which I understand you've been listening to obsessively.
Yeah, it's my true and only passion, really, is that one. Yeah, it's Taylor Swift.
That was coming out, did you?
I know all of her songs, such as Taylor Swift's song A. That's the one.
Okay. No, yeah. We're not actually doing that one.
No. I did know that she had a new album and people didn't like her single from like a month ago or something. That's my hot take on Taylor Swift.
The single is really weird in that the first single doesn't really belong on the album and the rest of the album isn't like it. So anyway, sure. That's my 5 second Taylor Swift review. Sean, why couldn't we podcast last week?
Oh, Jonathan, let me count the ways. So there's like, it was a perfect storm of shit. That's the right word to use there. I mean, there was just a combination of stuff of that. I was extremely busy with things. And so it would have been hard to do the podcast anyways, just because I had a lot of stuff going on. Then, alongside that was we were having, our roof was being repaired also. And just dealing with people coming in out of the house for that, because there was a pretty bad hailstorm several months ago. And so finally we got around to, okay, we need to have our roof shingles and shit replaced.
And we almost always record at your house.
Yeah. So that was happening, and that's really disruptive. But the big thing was, that there was one day I woke up. I woke up early in the morning and I left, and then I came back in the afternoon to the house and I was told that a toilet had exploded. And it turned out that there was a blockage in one of our main sewer lines at the house that was apparently super, super deep in the line, such that it had probably been there for a while, and in such a way that there had been a small buildup of sewage in the basement of the house, which is where we record this podcast. That made it basically, nobody could be down here for 5 days or so. There are people had to come in and clean and with antimicrobial shit and spraying stuff. Our old storage room that luckily I spent a lot of time last summer clearing a bunch of old shit out of this old storage room. That was basically totally fucked. And anything that was not in a plastic container was beyond repair. So we had to pull all that stuff out of that storage room. Tiling in the bathroom had to be ripped out. There's a whole section of carpet against one wall that had to be ripped out. That is a wall that is adjacent to that storage room. And it was just generally an unpleasant affair. All around, and then this basement is also where my PlayStation is, it's where my TV is also where I'm attending school again to get a teacher's license, which is a huge amount of work. And so I usually use this table that we record this podcast on is also where I usually do all that schoolwork. And it just so happened that the weekend around which all this shit was occurring is also the weekend around which I had to do a huge assignment for that, that takes upwards of 20 hours to complete. And so I spent this whole weekend locked in my room, sitting on the edge of my bed with my laptop on an ironing board at the edge of my bed, because there was basically nowhere else for me to do all this work, with books just strewn all about the place, and me just seething in my just frustration of being why did this all have to happen right fucking now? This is literally the most profoundly inconvenient time for this to ever occur. There's no convenient time, but if this had been 2 weeks ago, I could have very easily dealt with it. It being right now is like, fuck off. Just fuck off, world. Why in 2017? Why in my busiest week? Why right now?
I think that is a perfectly legitimate excuse to miss a podcast.
Yes, I felt so. I felt justified.
I think that's fine.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think they'll forgive us.
Yes.
We're also doing two this week, so if you don't, fuck you guys. I mean,
yeah.
You work hard.
Exactly. No. So that's why...
So perfect storm of shit. Good pun.
Yes. Yes. That's why we are late, is that we couldn't have survived the fumes had we tried.
Well, there you go. And the news of the real world wasn't much more pleasant.
Exactly, yeah. It was just bad all around.
Yes. So that's kind of your stuff for the week, I assume.
More or less, yeah.
All right. We're going to talk about some other pieces of stuff in the next episode. But anything more substantially like review-focused, we're going to talk about on the next show. So for now, you want to dive into some news, Sean?
I'm going to regret saying this, but what's been going on in the news, Jonathan?
All right. So here's what's going to happen, guys. We're going to talk about the sexual politics of the entertainment, media, and political industry for a little bit.
Yeah.
Because it's fucked. And then we're going to do our normal silly news about gameplay trailers and release announcements. And we get to... Here's my little cookie for everyone at the end of this tough discussion. We get to talk about how Universal canceled their Dark Universe project after one movie.
Right,
and
yes.
It'll be fun. It'll be a lot of fun. No one got hurt. It's just people were stupid. It's fun.
Yeah.
We'll get to talk about that. We got Star Wars news. We got the 13th Doctor got a costume. There's so much cool stuff to talk about, but we do have to do the hard stuff first.
Yeah, we got to get this out of the way, because it's also something of where, like, it's so wide-reaching and all-encompassing that since our podcast is, like, entertainment media-focused, we need to get this out of the way.
You know? I agree.
We need to talk about this stuff.
Yes, so Sean, I am going to read. I have put notes together. A list of people. It's organized entertainment first, which is kind of most of it, and then a couple in broader media that I'm calling it, and then a couple in politics. And the first part of the list is alphabetized by first name, because that was just the easiest way to do it.
Right.
And yeah, so I'm going to go through this, and then we'll react, okay?
All right.
All right. In entertainment, again, this is not organized by any other way than alphabetical. Andrew Kreisberg is suspended from the CW superhero shows. He was the executive producer of shows such as Supergirl, The Flash, Legends of Tomorrow, and Arrow. After a culture of workplace harassment is internally uncovered with 19 women coming forward, an internal investigation is ongoing. Ben Affleck was accused by actress Hillary Burton of groping her on an old MTV program. There is video evidence of this. Ben Affleck did apologize on Twitter. Bob Weinstein, brother of known rapist extraordinaire Harvey Weinstein, was accused by Amanda Siegel, a producer, of sexual harassment, and it seems like there will be more from this in the future. He also clearly knew about all his brother's misdeeds. So keep that in mind, too. Brett Ratner, one of the worst directors in Hollywood, not that that's really relevant, but just I want to say it, is accused of harassment, lewd contact, and assault by multiple women, including Olivia Munn, who had kind of been on the record in this direction for years, but had not fully been listened to. Ellen Page published a horrifying story on Facebook of him verbally harassing her in public on the set of X-Men 3 and making homophobic comments. I definitely recommend you read Ellen Page's sort of Facebook essay she wrote. It is horrifying, but also beautiful. Bryan Singer, speaking of X-Men, accusations against him have popped up every few years now. They came up around the release of X-Men Apocalypse. They surface again in the wake of all of this, that he was sexually coercive with younger men. I don't know if there was anything new here that I saw, but this has come up again.
Yeah.
Chris Savino of Nickelodeon was fired after a dozen women accused him of harassment in The Hollywood Reporter. Dustin Hoffman was accused by writer Anagram Hunter of harassment when she was 17 in 1985, and producer Wendy Gachinosis accuses him in Variety of sexual coercion in 1991. Ed Westwick of Gossip Girl, an actor on that show, was accused by actresses Christina Cohen and Ariel Wynn of rape, both in 2014, and Cohen has filed a police report. An investigation is ongoing. Eddie Berganza, a DC Comics editor against whom accusations have been leveled for years, creating a really hostile work environment at DC, is finally suspended after an exhaustive BuzzFeed report. And today, when we were recording this on November 13th, he was finally fired from the company. No word yet on what they would do in reparations to all the women who were fired or let go for speaking out against him. Actor George Takei is accused in The Hollywood Reporter by model Scott Brunton of groping him in 1981. On an episode of Howard Stern that resurfaces in the wake of this, Takei describes doing pretty much exactly what was alleged by Brunton in more generalized terms. Actor Jeremy Piven was accused by Ariane Bellamar of being groped on the set of Entourage. It's Entourage, I believe that one. I believe all of these? Yes. Anyway, Kevin Spacey was accused first by actor Anthony Rapp of underage sexual advances. Rapp was 14 at the time of the alleged assault. Other stories soon come out, including a persistent pattern of hostile behavior on the set of House of Cards. Spacey issues a strange apology where he deflects by coming out as gay. House of Cards production shuts down. They are rewriting the show to write out his character Frank Underwood for the sixth and what will now be final season. And Ridley Scott's film All the Money in the World, which was supposed to be an Oscar contender, is being partially reshot to replace all of Kevin Spacey's scenes with Christopher Plummer, and they are still aiming to do this by the December 22nd release date.
Yeah.
Which is crazy. Louis C.K., long-standing accusations that we have heard rumors about for years now were confirmed by the New York Times. Five women initially came forward for this story, that he cornered them, masturbated in front of them, pulled out his dick in front of them. Louis C.K. confessed to this in a half-hearted apology statement that mentions how admired he was by these women no less than four times. FX drops Louis C.K., the FX network, from all of their shows. Louis was in like kind of a permanent hiatus status, that show, but he was executive producer on four other shows, and he will be taken off of those. Luckily, those shows are not being canceled. Other cool people are working on those. We wouldn't want that. The release of his film, I Love You, Daddy, which everyone had basically confirmed was a cinematic admission statement, has been canceled by the distributor. However, not before press screeners went out, and I did in the mail today get a screener of this film, and just kind of felt sick to my stomach.
Yeah.
Yeah. Feel bad for, I feel semi-bad for all the critics who have, like, critical praise all over that screener, except I knew, you guys should have known.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah, so there's that one. Matthew Weiner, creator of Mad Men, was accused by Cater Gordon of making unwanted sexual advances in private. Cater Gordon was his assistant and later a staff writer and won an Emmy with Matthew Weiner for the season 2 finale, Meditations in an Emergency. She felt so uncomfortable around Matthew Weiner, however, she left the show and has not written in Hollywood since. Roy Price, the head of Amazon Studios, was suspended and later quit after a culture of harassment is uncovered. He famously canceled a show at Amazon called Good Girls Revolt, which is about a group of women rebelling against harassment in the workplace.
Yeah.
So, you know. Steven Seagal, accused by actress Portia de Rossi of unzipping his pants during a private audition. Jenny McCarthy and Julianne Moore make similar accusations. Writer-director James Toback first reported in the LA Times that he persistently assaulted, harassed women. The initial LA Times story had 38 women accusing. Over 200 more women subsequently contacted the LA Times to add their stories. That is one of the most horrifying in terms of the sheer impact. This is an older director who has been in the industry forever, and there are literally generations of women he harassed within the industry and assaulted. In media, larger media environment, Mark Halperin, an MSNBC analyst, longtime journalist, and author of the book Game Change, was accused of creating a persistent culture of harassment and has been fired by MSNBC. Many accusations against Mark Halperin. Michael Oreskes, top editor at NPR, put on leave after three female journalists come forward with accusations. Lockhart Steele, the editorial director at Vox Media, fired after reports surfaced of years of harassment. And in something that came to a head today, so this is still unfolding, Vince Ignito, a former IGN editor, was accused by Callie Plague, a former IGN employee, of a consistent culture of sexual harassment. IGN had basically ignored Plagey and covered it up while she was there. On November 13th, current IGN writer Alana Pierce, this is today, announced on Twitter that current IGN employees were on a walkout until the company issued a statement about these allegations. IGN editorial staff later responded with a later lengthy statement, but nothing so far has come from management or legal, and names were not mentioned in that statement. And in politics, this is one you've probably heard about. Alabama GOP Senate candidate Roy Moore is a pedophile, and the GOP doesn't give a shit. Now, that changed a little bit today. You had more people in Washington coming out in stronger terms, including our own senator from the state of Colorado, Cory Gardner, finally grew a fucking spine, and he's the head of the Senate Republican Committee and suggested that he be expelled from the Senate if he does get elected. In any case, these accusations were detailed in an exhaustive Washington Post report that had more than 30 sources. A woman named Leigh Korfman was 14 when Roy Moore was 32, and he tried to initiate a sexual encounter outside of a custody hearing. There are several other accusations, 30 witnesses interviewed for Washington Post, many others in subsequent reporting by other outlets. A fifth woman comes out on November 13th today alleging sexual assault when she was 15. And we also learned, this was in the New Yorker, that there was a mall in Alabama that Roy Moore in this period was banned from because he was so known for trolling for teenagers there. People within the state of Alabama, or Republican officials within the state of Alabama, have resolutely stuck by him, including comparing him to Joseph and Mary, the parents of Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
But as we
which
say,
which is insane in an uncountable number of ways.
We'll get there, Sean. And but at least GOP leadership in Washington does seem to be more on the track of trying to get him out of the race in one way or another. And while we're on all this, let's not forget current President Donald Trump has been accused by upwards of 15 women of harassment and assault and bragged about all of it on tape that voters saw weeks before they, sort of, in parentheses, elected him.
Yeah.
Just don't want to forget that one. So, Sean.
Yeah.
Other than a primal scream of rage, what has been your reaction to this flood of accusations in the last few weeks? And I should say also, that's probably not everything. It's almost certainly not everything.
Oh, no, yeah, yeah.
I looked as far as I could. You know, I'm sure there's ones I forgot. And I'm sorry about that. Did the best I could. And again, just as of taping, too, this is 7 o'clock on Monday night. There probably will be more of them by the time we're done.
Yeah.
This is, I think, a pretty significant historical moment.
Mm-hmm.
And again, other than the primal scream of rage, what has your reaction been?
I mean, like, it's something of there is definitely the primal scream of rage response, but it's also something of, like, I'm generally not surprised that these things happen. Like, I have known for a long time, like, not, like, specifically most of these, like, there are some, like, Louis C.K. for whom there have been rumors and, like unsubstantiated reports for, like, good reasons why they're unsubstantiated, that we can get into that for a while about that behavior in such a way that, like, I basically knew that. But for many of them, like Kevin Spacey, I had no idea if there were allegations or anything like that beforehand. But it's something of, like, I generally assume that in particularly in any structure where there's that system of power and power imbalance, where you have people that have power over other people, and in the kind of, like, in any industry, but particularly in the entertainment industry, that's obviously rife for that, that this kind of stuff goes on all the fucking time. And so there is, like, I think the optimistic and hopeful way of looking at this is that this shit is finally being exposed, and when it's being exposed, people are responding seriously to it, with the exception of when it happens in politics, and that's a weird fucking thing.
And that's why I would feel remiss not to put it in there.
Exactly,
because
yeah.
I do want to bring that up. There, this should be responded to the same, whether it's entertainment or politics.
It should be even stronger in politics. Like, we should hold politicians to an even higher standard than we hold actors, you know?
Yes.
Like, that should be far more stringent. But aside from, like the political sphere, which has its own weird fucking shit that's been going on for a while, in terms of the entertainment industry, this is, again, this is stuff of, like, that Louis C.K. stuff, I've known about that since, like, 2014 or whatever.
Yeah.
I think there's, like, that was when, like, there was a pretty big Jezebel article about it.
Which had its own issues, we can talk
about. Had its own issues. But, like, there have been, that stuff has been getting out there for a while, but it was getting out there in such a way that it was that sort of, like, you know, I know somebody who knows the people that this happened to and reporting on it that way without, like, those women feeling they were in a position where they could not or did not want to go on the record and, like, make these specific accusations against Louis C.K. because they would be, their careers would be affected by it. And especially you think about the climate in 2014, that maybe like those allegations would not be taken anywhere near as seriously as they are taken right now in this moment. And I think it's something of that, like, what has happened in the political sphere has pushed people so far that a lot of people that normally would, like, sort of kind of casually see that headline and completely ignore it now are like, no, there needs to be consequences for when people do this shit. Like, we can't just let it go by anymore. Because, like, there have been, this kind of shit has happened all the time. There have been things of, like Woody Allen is probably, like, the best example of, like, there being, like, a well-substantiated fucking article that, like, put out there that just says, yo, this fucking dude sexually assaulted me. Like, my dad sexually assaulted me, and that not being taken anywhere near
Woody Allen
the level
is...
of seriousness that it should have, I feel like if that article was published tomorrow, people would respond to it totally differently.
Woody Allen has a movie on the books ready to come out where, like, Kate Winslet is going to be nominated for an Oscar for it, and, like, you know, if you can drop the Louis C.K. movie, you absolutely should be dropping the Woody Allen movie and stop being in fucking Woody Allen movies, people in Hollywood.
Yeah.
Like, this is an easy one.
Like, if fucking Ridley Scott decides, I'm going to fucking make it so Kevin Spacey, who was in my movie that we just shot, is not in my fucking movie anymore, and we're still going to try to make it come out by the end of the year, you can say, hey, let's stop fucking being in Woody Allen movies. You know, like, let's stop supporting this guy.
Yeah, and Woody Allen's not on the list because those allegations are old at this point. I should say, one of the people who was instrumental in getting the Harvey Weinstein news out, and there was much new Harvey Weinstein news during our two-week break, is Ronan Farrow, the brother of Dylan Farrow, I think, is the young woman who Woody Allen molested as a kid when he was her stepfather. That's not the daughter he married, that's the daughter he molested.
Right.
Because he's a fucking creep. Anyway, yeah, and there's a snowball effect to this, and, you know, I'm of two minds, and the one mind is my heart breaks every time I hear one of these, and I hate that people had to go through this, and I hate that people, men in the industry, felt like they could just do whatever the hell they want, still feel like they can just do whatever the hell they want. My heart breaks for all the careers that were ruined by this. You know, the Matthew Weiner story, for instance, that's not the same thing as a lot of these other ones, but in terms of, like, he, you know, doing something like big and criminal on like a serial level. But that one is really illustrative of the impacts these can have, where Cater Gordon, the writer, who was clearly a really talented young writer, felt so uncomfortable that she just left the industry. And there's, you know, now a decade of work she didn't get to do and things like that. And so I feel so sad and angry for all of that, and I'm a white guy, you know, like, right, this is not even affecting me in the way it affects a whole segment of our population, but empathy is important. And yet, on the other hand, there is this, like, righteous anger to it of, thank God this is all coming out. I'm so sad that any of these women have to tell their stories, or have stories to tell, I should say. But at the same time, I'm glad that there is a moment in our culture now where people are feeling safe enough to come forward, flush this shit out in the open, and that for a large part, with, like, a lot of the names I read, there are consequences.
Yeah.
And things are changing in these places. Whether or not that's a long-term change that will be sustained, you know, that's up to Hollywood and to all of us being vigilant about it. But at the same time, it is just, you know, I am glad we are in a moment where these floodgates are breaking and these people can't hide anymore, and we can have an honest conversation about these issues and not let it be, you know, in a back page of the New York Times somewhere buried.
Yeah.
And I think that's good.
Yeah. And like you said, it's that there are, like, consequences are being meted out, you know, like, it's like Kevin Spacey's not in that movie anymore. He's not going to be in fucking House of Cards season 6, you know, like, Louis C.K.'s fucking career for the foreseeable future
is done.
You know, like, that's good. Like, that's what should happen. That's what's supposed to happen. That's the kind of shit that needs to happen to make sure that you break down that power dynamic. You break down that culture that allows men who are in power to exploit that power. You know, like, you need to make it clear that, no, like, if you step over the boundaries, and these are what the boundaries are, you're out. Like, you don't get to play anymore. You fucking go home.
Yes. You know, initially when I was writing this outline, I just had Louis C.K. and Kevin Spacey on it to talk about, just because they're two people we've talked about on this podcast before and appreciated their work. And then I realized I think it would be, you know, unfair to this moment to just talk about that. But I do want to focus on them for a second.
Sure, yeah.
Because they've certainly, of all the names I read, I think, for the entertainment side at least, had the most attention over these last few weeks. You know, those were the ones that got, like, you know, New York Times pop-ups on my phone. Like, that kind of big, high-level stuff.
Right.
And, you know, I don't think we've talked about the Louis C.K. allegations on the podcast before.
No.
I
know, again, it was the kind of thing of where, because there was no, like there was no clear, like, thing you could point people to say, like, this definitely happened. There was, like, the sense that it happened, but it was hard to substantiate it in any way.
Yeah, and I'll say for me, that sense had grown over the years that, you know, it's been a while since I watched or listened to any of his stuff.
Yeah, it's been a long time.
I just was too creeped out by all of it, and, you know, and it did seem at a certain point, like, okay, this is obviously a thing. This is not just, and that initial, like, not, it wasn't the first report ever on this. That Jezebel report from back in the day did have significant issues, including that report and several others cited a comedian named Jen Kirkman, who was one of my favorite comedians, who did not make allegations about right. Louis C.K. in this way. She had a podcast episode where she insinuated that he, or she didn't even say his name, had been kind of creepy, and then it was misconstrued by Jezebel. She took the podcast down, and for years has been trying to tell people, that's not my story to tell, that's not what happened, and these outlets weren't listening to her, and were still putting her name on the record for these things. And I actually think that's an important part of this, too, in that if you're going to do the footwork on this stuff, you have to do it well, or else it delegitimizes your reporting.
Right.
And one of the other things that I think is instructive about this moment is that it moved away from gossip blogs. Like, everyone's saying, like, oh, it's so sad that Gawker isn't around anymore. And I'm of two minds on that. It's like, well, one, yes, Gawker did break some of this. They also did a terrible job doing it. Yeah. And, like, there's two things going on there. And I'm glad that it's now in the, what I would call legitimate media, where real journalists are going after this. And you see, now that, like, that, because journalists are good at what they do.
Yeah.
And when the eye of journalism is turned on these people, there's a lot to uncover, and that's great. And that's part of the moment we are in. And that's part of why I'm glad this has moved into the zeitgeist, because now you have real professional journalists who can uncover this in a way that gets these fuckers dead to rights.
Yeah.
You know? But anyway, it had been a couple, you know, so the Louis C.K. thing, I was, you know, really sad to see the full story break. But I had also had a couple years to prepare for it, I feel like. And, you know, people have been talking a lot about just how many signifiers there are in his work about this. And it is, it's crazy when you think about it. Because there were a couple years there where he was really a very significant force, not just in stand-up, but obviously TV.
Right,
has influenced a generation of TV artists. And, you know, it's one of the hardest things to talk about here is that you can't now erase that past. But you also know future generation can go back and watch, like, Louis the same way.
Just, I mean, like, it's something that, like, if the human race still exists 100 years from now, which is an open question, I think we all need to constantly be reminded it's an open question. But 100 years from now, you will be able to look back on that, and I think it'll be an interesting, like, when, like, TV history is a class you take at university, that would be a fucking fascinating course. Once, like, all that's long dead and being like, look at this fucking dude. Like, look at, like, his weird, you know, like, issues projected in his stand-up and on his TV show. Because it is the kind of thing of, like, I think the one of the main reasons why, when I read some of the rumor blogs and stuff when that stuff was coming out, that, like, I basically was like, yeah, no, this tracks for me, is that, like, it is not surprising, if you are familiar with his work, that that is the dude he is. Like, I think, like, those, like, the idea of, like, oh, yeah, like, he also has, like masturbated in front of women against their will. Like, if Louis C.K. was to be, like to perform, like, sexual misconduct or harassment in some way, that is the exact way you would envision him doing it based on his stand-up. Like, yeah. I think, like, his art was a weirdly, like, honest reflection of who he was to a certain point. Obviously, like, not to the point of him, like, actually straight up admitting to doing this stuff.
But that's, like, that's one of the most maddening things about all this. That this guy can pour all of this shit into his work, which is this incredibly narcissistic way to deal with things and make other people watch it, and then on the other side discredit these women and squash these rumors and refuse to talk about it and all this. You know, this was coming. If he was really sorry, if he really felt bad about it, there are so many opportunities where he could have come clean.
Yeah, and that there's no world in which that would ever happen.
No, because that's not the pathology of these people. Now, the Kevin Spacey one, I have learned that apparently this was more of an open secret in the industry, but I don't think it leaked through to the public the same way.
Yeah, I'd never heard about it.
That was blindsiding. I couldn't have imagined that, personally. You know, I think there was always rumors that he was gay, but that's completely separate from being a rapist and assaulter. And especially for underage men, which is a whole other level of evil going on here. And that, you know, when it first came out and it was the Anthony Rapp allegation, And then you're like, is this one of those cases where this happened once, doesn't excuse it? But that's one level of evil. Right. And it's like, no, this was a persistent thing over his whole career, up to and including the set of House of Cards. And that just, it's crazy.
Yeah. And it was like, it was just specifically, it was the apology where he like,
oh God,
at this, like he admitted to doing that stuff, which is like, you know, that is the one thing you can say. It's like, at least like some of them, like Kevin Spacey and Louis C.K., at least they just said like, yes, I did this, because there's like the typical reaction usually is like to fiercely deny it and to accuse like the women as of being like literally of being hysterical. And like, there's like that whole history of doing that shit. And some of like these accusations like that, they have been responded in that way. At least Kevin Spacey and Louis C.K. just said like, yes, no, I did this. It's like, fuck it. Okay, good. Like, at least we can get to that part of the conversation without you being insane about it. But then, you know, Kevin Spacey then took that moment to come out, like officially come out as gay in a way that felt like it was like excuse, like it was his idea of excusing that behavior, which is like, no, like that's like, you can't, like, you're just like weirdly perpetuating the stereotype that gay men are sexual predators and assaulters. Like, that's not, don't fucking do this.
No, it's horrible. Yeah, and talking about apologies, I mean, I don't know if I mentioned it for everyone. A lot of these men have issued apologies, you know, some like, especially for ones where it seems like it was something longer ago and not necessarily part of a serial pattern like a Dustin Hoffman or something. They were very conciliatory in these, but there's a lot that were still very combative, you know. Matthew Weiner roundly denied it. I think a lot of these people have not issued anything. Bryan Singer has never really talked about this in public except trying to discredit the people, and I think there's more than a mountain of evidence about that. You know, it's...
Did Brett Ratner respond in any way? Because that's one of the ones where, like, Ellen Page's stuff is, like, so direct about him that it's like...
I'll say this. There's no fucking way Brett Ratner has the capacity for empathy large enough to know he did anything wrong.
Right, yeah.
That guy is a piece of shit. We have always known he's a piece of shit. He's a shitty director, too. That's a separate thing. We've always known he's a piece of shit. Like, back when he, like, called someone the N-word before the Oscars. Or was it a fag? Something like that. He used some kind of epithet. And he was going to be producing the Oscars. And he got kicked off that, luckily. Because some idiot thought that was a good idea. But no, I don't. The other Brett Ratner story that's later on my news outline, but might as well talk about it now, is Gal Gadot, Wonder Woman.
Right, yeah.
Who, in addition to being a great actress, is also apparently a really cool person. Is using contract negotiation leverage with Warner Brothers and has said, I will not do Wonder Woman 2 or future movies unless you kick Brett Ratner off of this. And that's because Brett Ratner owns a production company called Rat Pack. Great, you know, clearly a good guy owns that thing. Anyway, and it's Rat Pack with a PAC at the end.
Oh, sure.
Anyway, that co-financed Wonder Woman 1 and would have a co-financing deal for the sequels, of course. And she's demanding they buy him out and have him completely removed from the production if she's going to go forward. And she's in a position to do this because, as a woman, they offered her a much shorter term contract than they did people like Ben Affleck or Henry Cavill.
Right.
And now they're being fucked by it.
Yeah.
So Gal Gadot is the real life Wonder Woman.
Yes.
Yes. If there was a Wonder Woman, either she would just go kick Brett Ratner's ass, or I think she would use contract negotiation leverage. Wonder Woman's smart that way, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, that's cool. But God, it so much. I mean, it's just, there's a whole range of things here, too, from ones that were, you know, surprising to, like, old news, like the Eddie Berganza stuff at DC Comics. I mean, I've seen people tearing their hair out on Twitter and stuff for years now about that. Like, this is... And there's a ton of these in the comics industry.
Yeah.
Because that's a real boys club. And it's, again, good it's happening, but, God, there are places, though, where you look at it, it's like, the only solution for the comics industry is to tear the whole fucking thing down and start over. Like, I don't think there's any way you fix that culture looking at it.
Yeah, because it's like, there's that one specifically, it's such like, because it's kind of like Hollywood, but it's such a like smaller, like denser version of it that, yeah, like there are people in that industry. And that's like, I mean, the comics industry has been so fucked forever. If you just go back to, I mean, literally like the origins of comic books, it's all been about like exploiting the writers and in the particularly the artists, and in financial ways and personal ways. And yeah, it's fucked. It's all fucked.
It's all fucked. And, you know, I'm not saying people... Like, I want there to be a space for women and people of color and people who've been exploited to write comics if that's their passion. just this industry is, that industry is fucking toxic.
Yeah.
These are all toxic, but that, you know, I don't know what the redemption path is for that one.
Yeah.
You know, I think step one for all these industries is get rid of all these people, you know, flush them out and fire them and don't let them come back. There's plenty of other people who can do their jobs.
Yeah.
Including women.
Yeah.
You know, and people who have been, as I said, exploited. And that's step one. And then step two is to work really hard to make sure it never fucking happens again. Or yeah. as little as possible. In that, you know, you cannot foresee every bad person, but you can work really hard to make sure they don't have a fucking outlet for it.
Exactly, yeah. And just create systems and structures that prevent them from being able to exploit that power. And then, like, put in means by which you can more naturally and easily remove them should they exploit their power in a way that's not like, well, we need to have fucking like the New York Times put together a massive article that takes like a month of work, you know?
Yeah, just, you know, and we're also seeing all these ones at media outlets, which that's a whole other, you know, side to this too, which is that there's a gatekeeper aspect to all this. When you have these men in positions of power who abuse their power in these ways, and especially when you get to the level of, like, news media and stuff, that informs generations of coverage. And part of why we don't hear about this stuff is because of that gatekeeper effect.
Yeah.
You know, the Mark Halperin one is huge. This is a guy who has been in this industry forever. I think he was a lead editor at ABC News for a long time. There was a really interesting bonus podcast by the 538 team that I would recommend listening to that they did with some former employees of ABC News talking about this, that this is... The Halperin stuff has been an open secret in the industry forever. And now, you know, you go back and look at his coverage of people like Hillary Clinton in his 2008 book, Game Change, and then now in the 2016 election as an MSNBC outlet. And, you know, he's an influential journalist and a huge part of how media views, you know, women like Hillary Clinton in such a sexist light
right.
is because you have these kind of gatekeeper figures in media. And why, you know, this stuff doesn't break out in the entertainment industry. You know, you got like IGN and stuff is because there's toxic environments. And I think we all could have assumed IGN was a toxic environment.
Yeah.
But seeing, I mean, that was actually pretty inspiring today to see that staff walk out and be like, no, we deserve to, you know, we're good journalists too. We deserve to have a voice. You guys are full of shit.
Yeah.
And I'm glad that happened. You know, but all at all of these levels, it's part of why getting rid of these people is so important, is because you don't get progress if they're not gone and new people who can actually allow for change come in.
Yeah.
And that's where we need to talk about politics, I think.
Uh-huh.
Because I think one of the starkest things that's been going on is, let's say, entertainment and media is on the left here and politics is on the right here. And over, and I don't mean left-right politically.
Right.
But it is actually kind of
it is, yeah.
But like on my left-hand side here, you see everybody from all walks of life, unless they're Russian bots or weird Gamergate trolls, saying, this is shitty, I'm glad these people are gone, these people are horrible. You know, in general, people have the right response. There are generally consequences for these actions. You know, the right things are generally happening, even if in a lot of cases they should have happened a lot earlier. At least they're happening now.
Yeah.
And people, there's you know, been so much less of... Well, this is a witch hunt against men. It's like, no, at the point where it's a full-on zeitgeist moment, that's always a bullshit excuse, but you really can't make it, so people yeah. aren't, you know, are going back into their sexist hidey holes. And yet, over on the right, in politics, it's like an alternate dimension. It's yeah. like a parallel world where there isn't this other zeitgeist, and people in Alabama and in the GOP leadership are arguing about the moral relativity of pedophilia.
Yeah.
And I feel like I'm insane looking at it. Like, something does not compute. Is it me? No. I know pedophilia is wrong. It's them.
Yeah.
And this is nuts. Like, it's not a hard question. Do you think there should be pedophiles in your party? No. We can all say that. This is not a hard stance. I don't care how strongly you feel about your pet issues like gun control and abortion rights and all that shit. There is nothing on that side. Like, if as a Democrat... If, like, my Democratic Senate candidate came out, we learned was a pedophile, there's no way on earth uh-huh. I would support that person,
yeah.
and I would probably support the Republican over them as long as they weren't a pedophile. This is not hard. And yet, you look at it, and it's a different world over there, and I don't get it.
It's just this inability to recognize fault at any point. And it's like this need to be right, like correct 100% of the time to a point where it is psychopathic effectively on like this mass scale that is fucking horrifying. And it's like it is that sort of, it's that weird culture and philosophy that puts Donald Trump in the White House when everything he says is basically either like just wrong or deliberately false. Like, is this a fucking lie, or he just doesn't know what the fuck he's talking about at all? He's like constantly diverts information. He's constantly just saying insane shit that makes no sense whatsoever. Where if you like ever just pay attention, like try to pay attention to like the actual literal words he's saying and not necessarily like the broad gist of kind of what he's trying to communicate, you're like, what the fuck are you even talking about? Like, that culture of like, well, it's like he's the Republican candidate, therefore you have to support him because the Republican candidate has to be perfect and true for the Republican Party. Like, that's what that is. And so, yeah, it is where he, like, Trump had the video where, you know, he admitted to sexually assaulting women. Now we have this more motherfucker who's a pedophile. And, like, they're just like, you know, a lot of Republicans are still going to support him just because he's the Republican candidate in that area.
And it's, again, like the parallel world thing. Like, other than maybe the James Toback stuff and the Harvey Weinstein stuff, there was none of these harassers had a report issued against them as long and detailed and exhaustive as the stuff against Roy Moore.
Yeah.
You know, like that Washington Post story, it's really long. It's got over 30 sources. They are super upfront, like more than you would actually usually be about how they got this story, who these people are, that the primary accuser in that, who was 14 at the time, is a Trump voter.
Right.
Which I'm not using that against her. I'm just saying they told her, like, she doesn't have a political agenda here. That's not the point. You know, that's part of why they. And normally I don't think they'd even mention that in the story, but you kind of have to in this moment to try to explain that. This is not someone just doing a political hit job, which doesn't really happen either.
Yeah.
So, you know, fuck that. But it's. And so you have all that. And again, like, if that was forced, if Roy Moore was, like, you know, the head of Hulu or something, he'd be gone.
Yeah.
And he wouldn't work in the industry again, hopefully. But because it's in politics, you get the fucking Joseph and Mary description. And we compare this guy to Jesus Christ. It's unreal. And I think you have to hold on to this anger because we cannot let this become normal. Yeah. You have to remember that this is fucking insane. And I remember a few days before the Roy Moore story broke, and this, you know, flood of accusations was coming in entertainment and media, and I thought to myself, you know, if the presidential election were this year, after this moment, which couldn't happen because this moment is in large part because of that, but just for the sake of argument, I wonder if those accusations against Trump would stick more. I wonder if they'd be taken seriously if they were, you know, in a moment where this was the zeitgeist. And then the Roy Moore stuff comes out and there's still people dismissing it. And it's like, okay, it seems like it's sticking a little more, but not entirely. And it should just be disqualifying. And before anyone comes at us with, but what about Bill Clinton or something?
That's not the fucking point! We're not talking about Bill Clinton!
And
like,
you know
he's not even running for office anywhere!
And just to indulge you for a second, I was 1 month old when he was elected president.
Yeah.
You weren't born yet. You were born like 3 weeks after he was elected president. So, not my issue.
Yeah.
Sorry, I don't have. And you know what? If he was running today and we knew what we knew now, yes, I would have serious reservations about Bill Clinton.
Yeah, me too.
Because he's fucking creep. But we're not talking about him. Has no bearing on the current issue.
Yeah, it is that weird. I think the other one was fucking Ann Coulter on Twitter fucking made a tweet that was about like JFK.
Dated a 19-year-old.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, well, what about this? Ha ha. It's like, what do you think I'm going to say? That like, oh, because because JFK was a Democrat and we generally like JFK, that means that we have to support all, like, creepy old men dating really young women or, like, women who are, you know, not legal. No, that's not my reaction. My reaction is not to be so entrenched in this weird arbitrary political affiliation that I then completely throw away every single moral and ethical precept that I live by. That's not what I do. I just say, yeah, John fucking Kennedy shouldn't have fucking done that. That's the same thing you do. You don't fucking throw away your philosophy with which you approach life because you're a Democrat or because you're a Republican and that one person that you used to like you find out is an asshole.
I think I am a pretty empathetic person and I am good at understanding people. I cannot understand the mindset of an Ann Coulter or a Sean Hannity who is that cynical that it's like, well, my worldview is if they're on my team, I don't give a shit what they did,
yeah.
So you shouldn't either. What is that? How dead inside do you have to be? What has to happen to you in your life? What part of you is missing that that is your reaction to this and not, I am so sorry that someone who wears the same party flag as me did this to you. Yeah. That's step one. You know?
Yeah.
It's insane.
The bizarre and utterly warped mindset that you would think that the JFK or Bill Clinton stuff is some sort of gotcha moment that's like, oh, well, yeah, now that you've said that, I can't possibly still be staunchly against sexual harassment and pedophilia.
It's nihilism, you know, as politics.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, Friedrich Nietzsche himself would come back and look at this and be like, you're taking it a little far.
Yeah.
Like, some things do matter.
Yeah.
While we're on, let's all at least agree while we're on this earth, let's not rape and assault each other.
Yeah.
You know? And let's not condone those who do it. Like, yeah. I don't care how nihilistic you are, you should at least be able to agree on that.
Also, let's not compare him to one of, like, the foundational members of your fucking own religion, which is, like, a really insane...
Jesus God.
A really insane reaction to have.
And that, I mean, and that's... There's this whole thing with, you know, the evangelical vote in the South... which just increasingly seems to mean nothing other than we will vote for every sex predator as long as they, I don't know, vote for tax cuts for the rich, something like that. And people, and you know, I heard things like, well, actually, you know, in evangelical culture, they look at it as just like, then they're fucked. That's fucked up too. Like, that's a cultural issue in the United States, which is why we have laws and a Congress and like to, you know, restrain our baser instincts.
Yeah.
You know, and get rid of that shit. Like, you know, I just, it sickens me. It sickens me. And I remember, I heard today on a lot of the things I kind of read and listen to, all these explanations for trying to be like, you know, let's get into the mindset of these voters in Alabama who are still with Moore and why we can excuse it. And it's like, I'm not going to say every one of those people who votes for him is a bad person, because I don't think that, but that's a bad thing to do.
Yeah.
And you can't excuse it. And, it, you know... If there was, you know, our next Democratic Senate candidate in Colorado came out like this or something, and I still just supported him and compared him to Jesus, I'd hope you'd hold that against me too.
Yeah.
You know, like...
I would be very confused if you did that, Jonathan, personally.
It would be a little out of character for me, I feel like. But, like, voters aren't out of the picture in this. They do have a role and they do have agency.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't think it's okay to brush that aside. And yes, there are larger like media and cultural trends that lead to this moment. And you have people being manipulated by propaganda outlets and the fake news bullshit and all that. But it still comes down to people do have a choice. You don't have, no one forces you to support a child molester.
Yeah.
I feel like, and I don't know why that's not just the simple starting point for all these
conversations. Like, that should be, that's like the most depressingly necessary bumper sticker of all time is nobody is forcing you to vote for a child molester. Fucking put that on your car and drive around Alabama for an hour.
I mean, hey, Alabama Democrats, there's still a month in this election. Yeah. So it's, yeah, I, you know, and step one just needs to be for politicians. How do we make sure this guy isn't a senator? And that's it. And I, for me, whether or not that means that our Democratic senator wins is like fifth down the list of important things in this.
Yeah.
You know, it's an opportunity. Yes. And, you know, Doug Jones is a better person and should be the senator there. But like that's so secondary to Roy Moore for reasons we should say. He's a monster way before you get to the child molestation stuff.
Yes. Yeah.
But like above and beyond the pale of even like a fucking Donald Trump. I mean, it's insane. But yeah, I... And it's just, there's this moment, and it's just that disconnect is one of the most disconcerting things to me, where over here, I see positive changes being made as a result of this flood of information. And over here, nothing.
Yeah.
Or at the very most, they're being dragged kicking and screaming to denounce a child molester. And that disconnect makes me feel very pessimistic about the future of our society.
It's a crazy moment we're living in. Like, it is just this... It is that there are those sections of the population in that political sphere that, like, have just decided no matter what happens, they're going to dig their fucking heels in deeper and deeper and deeper until they're fucking in the center of the earth, you know?
And they come out on the other side.
Yes.
And then they set up a colony in Australia. And you know what? They can do whatever the hell they want over there.
there's a lot of, like, I watched Lord of the Rings and shit. Like, there's, like, Australia, New Zealand, it's just empty fields as far as the eye can see, as far as I know. There's It'll one, in Australia, there's one building, and it's the Sydney Opera House, and everything else is just the outback. That's what movies have
taught
me.
Maybe that's how Mad Max Fury Road came about, is all the crazy people from our country just dug through the center of the earth and came out in Australia, and that's where, like, the king of Mad Max Fury Road, the Imperator was.
Yeah.
Anyway, you know, I'm just, because you had this sewage issue, you have a lot of stuff from your storage out, Sean.
Yeah.
Including a couple of Barack Obama posters from 2008.
Yes. Yeah.
And so throughout this conversation, I've been seeing the famous Hope poster with Barack Obama. And I said this to you off the air, but I think it's worth repeating here. You know, one day we're going to tell our children or nephews and nieces or someone younger than us, No. The Trump thing was after Obama.
Yeah.
No. I know it seems like the Obama thing should have been like, that's our redemption. But no, it was the other way around. And, you know, I will tell them about, man, 2008 and then 2012 felt so hopeful.
Yeah.
And it felt like we're working through our shit as a society. And it's not perfect, but we elected a really cool dude president.
Yeah.
And he did some good shit. And now it's like darker than ever. And hopefully we'll get another hopeful moment.
Yeah, hopefully this is like the dark middle chapter. You know, like Barack Obama was the new hope. Now we're in Empire Strikes Back. And then off the other side, we'll fucking throw Donald Trump into the reactor core of the Death Star. And he'll blow up. And then we'll all dance on Endor with a bunch of teddy bears.
Oh, someone make that Photoshop video, please.
Yes.
Yeah. Anyway, but instead of Donald Trump going down the thing just yelling no, it would be fake news! And he'd be tweeting.
Fucking Donald Trump, like, thinks he invented the word fake. It's just every single day. It's like, you are, Donald Trump is the shit that we make up about North Korea that's crazy. Like, it's not even the shit about North Korea that's actually crazy. It's the shit that, like, we make up because we think we know how crazy North Korea is. That's what fucking Donald Trump does, is he thinks he invented the word fake and tells people that. That's the world we live in.
All right. You want to move on?
We have to move on.
All right. I know there's no way to do full justice to this topic, but I hope that was at least a little cathartic and I don't know, a good way to work through some of these emotions and thoughts.
Puts all the cards on the table.
Let's talk about some news. Sean, I've got these organized for gaming news, movie news, and TV news, and there's crazy stuff in all of them.
Yeah, a lot happened.
Let's start with gaming news.
What happened in the world of video game news, Jonathan?
One of the big topics that would have been on, like, last week's show is that PlayStation had a big show at Paris Games Week.
Yes.
Which I kind of came out of nowhere. I don't feel like they really piped it.
From what I understand, like, I don't think this has been officially said, but it's sort of been, like, kind of talked about in back channels or whatever. From what I understand is that a lot of the stuff that they showed at Paris Games Week was originally stuff that they were going to show at PSX, which is, like, in a month or so now, which I have no idea what they're going to show at PSX now. But I think it's something that Sony of Europe and, like, the Europe branch of Sony was like, we want stuff for our show. Like, we want to have a show that's our show because, obviously, E3 and PSX are both in America. So it seems like, from what I, again, that's not like fully substantiated or anything, but from what I understand, that's kind of why that shit kind of came out of nowhere. And like a week before Paris Games Week, the Sony Twitter account or something came out and said like, by the way, you might want to pay attention to this because this is where all our announcements are all of a sudden.
This was frankly like, there were more surprises than E3 this year.
In some ways, yeah. Like, there were more, like, there's, I mean, they at least had, like, that one big new game announcement. And E3 was mostly, like, them kind of going over some old stuff and third-party stuff.
So, I'm going to go bottom to top on how I wrote this down and start with kind of the smaller stuff. So, we had a lot of indie game announcements. One was, there's a new game from the Voxel Agents called The Gardens Between, which is coming out in 2018. Looks kind of cool. Very much, that's a Sony platform indie game.
Yeah.
We also have from Pixelopus, the developers of Entwined, a game called Concrete Genie, announced for 2018. And of all their indie stuff, this was my favorite announcement.
Yeah, I really liked that trailer. It was because that's like the graffiti game, right? Yeah, where it's like graffiti kid, art. Yeah, like doing graffiti art, and they like kind of come alive. And the system in the trailer that they showed looked interesting. Of you kind of like picking from prefab parts, like I think they showed him picking like this kind of these sets of horns. But then instead of it just like you sort of like them being stickers that you just stamp on, it's kind of like a template that you then kind of can like expand and twist them and get them then like curve them in different ways. And And that looked like really interesting to me.
Yeah, I think it looks really cool. And I loved Entwined, their first game. It's a very small game, but I think it's a promising debut. This looks much bigger, and I'm excited to see how that goes.
Yeah.
A bunch of sequels to famous indie games were announced. Loco Roco 2, Guacamelee 2, and Spelunky 2 are all coming out. And I assume those will all be multi-platform, but they're probably at least launching on Sony. So that was interesting. Shadow of the Colossus, that remake, they announced the date for that. It's February 6th. Kind of cool just to know that that's coming. It is going to be, if you have the PS4 Pro, at 60 frames per second, which is pretty neat, because that's the kind of game you would not normally on a console see at that frame rate, because it's a very busy game.
Because also the original Shadow of the Colossus is sort of infamous for having a very poor frame rate.
So people were excited about that. But yeah, I'll talk a little bit later about how January and February are busy months for gaming. I don't know if I'm going to be able to get to this, but I'm glad that's coming.
Yeah.
Destiny 2, Curse of Osiris was formally announced. That's going to be the first expansion for Destiny 2, and it launches December 5th.
Yeah, and it was also like all stuff that if you've been paying attention, we knew all of it beforehand, because that story, I think that story broke before Destiny 2 came out, that there was going to be all the Mercury stuff.
Bungie runs a leaky ship.
Yeah.
Which is fine. But yeah, I think it's nice that Curse of Osiris will be here just in time for us to like reevaluate Destiny 2 before top 10 lists.
Yeah, it's a nice convenient way to go back and be like, okay, what was this game? Right.
Yeah, yeah. Let's see, we got a new trailer for the Spider-Man game by Insomniac. Yes. Very good. Not like gameplay heavy in the way the E3 demo was, but still very cool. A lot of story stuff. This is a Spider-Man who's like in college, a little older. Almost more like the Tobey Maguire kind of Spider-Man.
Yeah.
We also saw more of how Miles Morales is going to fit into this. We saw a little from the villains. There, you know, multiple villains.
Yeah, there's more Mr. Negative in there in Kingpin.
Looks good.
Yes. And like it was specifically because, you know, I've played a lot of Spider-Man games because Spider-Man is my favorite superhero. And typically, Spider-Man games don't really do almost anything with Peter Parker. Like, I think the Spider-Man 2 and Spider-Man 3 movie games did a little bit, but generally speaking, they kind of, like, never deal with the Peter Parker side of the character at all, because obviously, you know, they wanted
like,
web-sling and stuff like that.
Kind of like how the Batman Arkham games, he's never Bruce Wayne.
Right, yeah, it's like the beginning of Arkham City, and I think, like, one side quest in Arkham Knight are the only times you're actually, like, controlling not Batman Bruce Wayne. Like, he's in his normal suit. And so for this trailer, they showed a lot of Peter Parker outside of the costume, like in cutscenes mostly, but there was one really interesting part of the trailer that's very quick, where it was a like bank scene that reminded me a lot of Spider-Man 2, where like some villain is attacking a bank, and there's a really quick, like probably 2 or 3 second shot with MJ in the center of the frame, and then the camera rotates in such a way that if you've ever played a third person video game, you immediately recognize that, oh, that person is controlling MJ. Which I assume that's not going to be like a huge part of the game. It's like MJ's this fully playable character or something. But it seemed to imply that in certain story sequences, like it looked like it was like a stealth part or something that maybe you get to play as MJ a little bit, which that's a really cool idea.
Yeah, this game looks as good as we've been hoping.
Yes, I'm really happy that they are emphasizing the full breadth of the character for the story side of things, because it's one of the things that for Spider-Man games, Peter Parker is such an important facet of that character that if you're trying to tell a Spider-Man story, you need to address how does Peter Parker fit into that. And I'm glad that they're not afraid to go to that direction, because they just assume that everyone wants to be Spider-Man 100% of the time.
Yeah, it looks good. Do we think this is a 2018 game?
I can see fall 2018, I wouldn't be surprised if it was pushed to spring 2019, but...
Yeah, I imagine the plan is fall 2018, because they've shown so much at this point, but like, we'll see. I hope it is. I want to play it.
Yeah, I really want to play it.
All right, God of War got a really cool new gameplay trailer where we just see Kratos and his son kill some motherfuckers.
Yeah, it's basically, I think it was just sort of their response to old God of War fans being like, why are you showing all these fucking cinematic trailers? I just want to kill shit. Which, as someone who really enjoyed the God of War games, I understand that reaction, even if I'm like really interested in the cinematic side of things. So I appreciate them being like, okay, fine. We'll just show you Kratos fucking shit up in like a normal combat scenario. And it looked really cool.
I am so excited for this game.
I really like every time he throws the axe and it comes back to him, especially having watched Thor Ragnarok. I want to play a game where you can do the kind of shit that Thor does at the beginning of Thor Ragnarok with his hammer.
We are in the middle of a renaissance for Norse mythology stuff.
It's true.
We've got Thor, Hellblade, Senua's Sacrifice this year. It also ends with you fighting Hela. We got God of War coming out. I know that's moving more to like Greek mythology.
Well, but it's Kratos, who's from the Greek shit, moving to the Norse shit. So
okay, that's what we're doing.
Yeah,
now.
It is Norse mythology.
Okay. I forgot which way it goes.
Yeah, because Jormungand is in the last. It was in the E3 trailer. So,
and there's been other stuff that I'm forgetting, but there's been a ton.
Yeah.
Anyway, they're still committing to early 2018 for that. I don't know what that quite means.
Yeah.
I assume that'll wind up eventually in, like, the May slot Uncharted 4 did, but we'll see.
Probably, yeah, I can see that.
Which technically is, like, Q2, so not early, but we'll see. They have, I think, smartly not announced a date yet. they're waiting. All right, The Last of Us Part 2 got another trailer, and this was a big 5-minute cinematic trailer, no gameplay still.
It was basically like a horror short film was what it kind of played to me.
Because none of the characters from Last of Us 1, these are all new characters, one of whom is voiced by Laura Bailey, and it was really gruesome.
Yeah. Like I said, it basically played like a horror short movie. Like in a way that like I think, because it was something that a lot of people had a pretty like negative reaction to it, I think coming immediately out of the show. That makes a lot of sense to me of like, I don't know why this is the trailer you would show on a big press conference stage. Like, because I didn't watch the Paris Games Week thing live. I just watched the trailers after the fact.
Right, me too.
So like, I can see in that setting, like reacting really negatively to it. But it's something of like, I think I watched it at like 11 o'clock at night, like in the dark on my laptop. I found it like, again, like just like this really effective short horror piece that is like really brutally violent, but not in any way that would surprise you if you played The Last of Us, I think.
Yeah, I mostly agree. I think if, you know, we assume this game is not coming out 2018.
Oh, no. Yeah, this is definitely 2019. I think that's the other side of it, is that this is probably one of the only completed cinematics they have to even show of the game yet, is probably one of the main reasons why it was this, is like they probably didn't have a lot to choose from.
Well, and that's the thing. It will annoy me if we get a drip drop like this for 2 more years.
Sure.
Like, I would much rather they just kind of leave it on the side until they have something a little more holistic to show. Because, like, that's part of it, is that this is mostly 4 minutes of brutality completely removed from context, and I think that's part of why it played negatively to a lot of people. I think it's a beautifully directed scene. I think the graphics are amazing. You know, I got to watch this in, because they had it up to 4K, and my laptop is a MacBook, so it's like above 1080p, but less than 4K, so it like scaled to the native resolution. Looked amazing. But it's just, again, it's like, okay, people got really hurt. Like, to what end? Which, The Last of Us is all about that context, so that's fine.
But I think it is, like, one of the things that did annoy me about that reaction to the trailer was, like, it's fine to have that response, but I wish that more of, like, the think pieces that came out immediately after at least acknowledged that, like, it was not, the story or whatever of the trailer was not nihilistic. It was not that these people got tortured and then killed and that was it.
Sure,
they were tortured and then they fought back and triumphed over the people that were torturing them and then, like, were facing the horde of zombies to, you know, resist into the and survive into the future, which felt like that is basically the story of The Last of Us, is you suffering intense physical and emotional pain, but trying to survive despite that no matter what. Like, that is basically what that story was.
Sure, no, but it, and it has that. I'm just saying, when it's all new characters and we don't really know this scenario, I understand the like visceral negative reaction. I agree. I thought the think pieces were poorly written.
Yeah.
But yeah. Anyway, that game will come out in 2025. Let's see. Sucker Punch, who've been off the scene for years, the developers of the Infamous series, have announced here at Paris Games Week their new game, Ghost of Tsushima, with an amazing cinematic trailer.
Yeah.
I'm hyped for this.
It was so amazing to me. Just like, it's just one of those things of like, oh, you made a video game for me. Thank you very much, guys.
But it's also, it's totally like the Horizon Zero Dawn moment for, what's that developer?
Guerrilla Games.
Guerrilla Games, where it's like, oh, this is what you really wanted to make.
Uh-huh,
right?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
And I love Infamous Second Son. I think it's a great game. But you can just feel like, in this trailer, like a bunch of developers being really excited to make their cool new samurai game.
Yeah. And in particular, it's because it's not just a samurai game. I think it's cool they've gone for a very different, like, really unique setting, because most samurai stuff is set either, like Nioh, which I'm still playing through right now, which is set, like, around the year 1600, which is that Sengoku period, or it's set in, like the long, like, 200 years of the Tokugawa era that, like, sort of follows that. That's where most of the samurai stuff, like, that's where, like, you know, almost, I think, every single, like, Kurosawa period piece is set in one of those two eras. Like, there's some movies are sometimes set in that more, like, Heian era, which is more, like, the 13th and 14th century. But this is very specifically set during the Mongol invasion of Japan, which happened like 1270 something, I think, which is one of the only moments in like the entirety of like Japanese history where the samurai fought anybody that wasn't just other samurai. you know, Japan historically was not an invasive country at all. Like, that was a relatively new thing in the 20th century. And so, not an invasive country, and also a country that was not typically invaded by outside forces. So the vast majority of conflict in Japan were civil wars. Like, that's what the Sengoku era was. That's like the Tokugawa era was, you know, like the samurai of the Tokugawa shogunate, like, oppressing people, or like, you know, the samurai who were out of a job, you know, Sanjiro style or something, Yojimbo style, walking around and fucking shit up. This is like, no, we are being invaded by the Mongols, by like Kublai fucking Khan. They're trying to take over Japan. We don't want that to happen, so we have to fight against that. And so the island of Tsushima is one of the first places where the Mongols landed. So that idea of like, that's where you're setting that game is so fucking cool to me, because it's not just a samurai game. It's a very specific samurai game with a very specific idea for like the premise and the setting.
Yes. No, it's awesome. And I just love that Sony is in this moment where they're letting these development studios that have been tied to these franchises that were like never actually lighting the world on fire.
Sure.
Just go do your own thing.
Yeah.
Just experiment. We're fine. We've got all the money in the world right now. And that's awesome. That so feels like, frankly, how we got a lot of these like franchises in the first place, which mm-hmm. is the PS2 being a huge success and just go, fly, spread your wings. And I love that.
Yeah, it has taken a long time for this generation and like the first parties of just this generation to come around to making new IPs. And that was one of like the most exciting things about Horizon Zero Dawn earlier this year. Is like, finally, someone made a fucking new video game in the AAA space that's like a whole new IP that feels really different. And I'm really glad that Sucker Punch is coming out. And it's, as much as I really loved Infamous Second Son, it's not just another Infamous game. It's something totally new.
And I'm not sure where you would go with Infamous after Second Son.
Yeah,
it's,
I think it'd
it's
be hard.
Totally fine. Like we don't need more of it, you know? Yeah. But yeah. Maybe Troy Baker can voice a samurai.
Sure.
I'm kidding. Get Japanese people.
Yeah. But which that is, like, the two people who are in the trailer are, like ethnically appropriate. Like, they did not just sort of, like, cast a bunch of white people to have bad Japanese-English accents or something.
Yeah. Luckily, I think that's also a moment we're getting past, which is good.
The one thing I do really hope for is that they do have a decent, like, Japanese dub of that game. Like, obviously, because it's an English studio, they're going to do their whole English voice acting stuff, and that's what it's going to be made for. But I would think it would be really cool if they also, for the Japanese market, and then also maybe for me, like, put that in there also.
Yeah, no, that'd be neat. All right, that's everything from PlayStation's event.
Yeah.
Let's do some pieces of video game launch, like, date news. PUBG, PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds, finally got a date for Xbox One.
Yes.
On December 12th. I'm really curious to see how this goes. Because PUBG, I've never played it, and I don't have a ton of interest in it, but, like, from everything I've heard, it's gotten really kind of rough on PC in that...
I think there's, like, a really big issue with cheaters for, like, the past couple of weeks in particular.
My understanding is that the game has gotten, frankly, too big for the small team that developed it to completely keep an eye on everything. Yeah. And now they've got this Xbox version. Xbox is launching in their game preview program. And at some point, like, early access means nothing when you can actually go buy a boxed copy of this game on December 12th, and it just says game preview on the front, but you still pay $40 for it. That's all skeevy. But, you know, we'll see. You know, someone asked me if I'd played this for, like, top 10 consideration. No, and I probably won't, but maybe. I don't have a PC that could play this. I might check it out on Xbox. I don't know.
I also just don't have, like, I'm curious about it and I'm interested in it, but, like, I don't have the time to...
No.
Dump a bunch of time into a multiplayer game that has a really high skill ceiling, you know?
Yeah. I'm glad it's expanding beyond just the PC audience. We'll see how it does on Xbox. That could be interesting.
Yeah. I am curious to see, like how people feel it plays with the controller and stuff like that, because it definitely, my impression of it and having watched videos of it, is that it's a very PC shooter. So, we'll see how it goes.
A game we really care about, though, got a release date announcement. And that is Digimon Story Cyber Sleuth Hacker's Memory, the sequel to the 2016 Game of the Year on Jonathan Lack's list, Digimon Story Cyber Sleuth. It is launching in the United States on PS4 January 19th, 2018. If you pre-order, you get bonus costumes and Digimon DLC. And why wouldn't you pre-order? It looks so good. It's going to be great. It's going to be our Game of the Year 2018. Who knows? I'm just kidding. But
we're never going to stop playing video games, are we?
No,
there's never going to be a break. There's never going to be a part where, like, the video games have stopped. I can do other things for a couple of weeks.
And Sean, here's the thing. When I looked that up, I realized, hey, isn't that the same date as... And isn't that the same... Oh, God. And so I put together With this in mind, Digimon Story is coming out January 19th. What you're referring to, Sean, is that I've put all the dates together. January 2018, and specifically the span from January 19th to January 30th, is the single craziest month of games I've ever seen. And I know we're just getting off like October of this year, which was pretty crazy.
Yeah.
This is crazier in part because every single one of the games I'm about to talk about is Japanese.
Yeah, and also it's just crazy because historically, like, no, I used to think there was a law that existed that said no video games can release in the month of January.
I know.
Because no video games ever fucking did for years. And then all of a sudden they're like, let's just put every video game out in January.
So here's what we have, Sean. Digimon Story 2 on January 19th.
Yeah.
On the exact same day, Ni no Kuni 2 is coming out. And I had Ni no Kuni 2 pre-ordered, and now I have to choose. And my heart goes with Digimon, but I do really want to play Ni no Kuni 2.
Me too.
So we'll have to make that decision. On January 23rd, 4 days later, the Tokyo RPG Factory with Square Enix is launching Lost Sphere.
Right.
Which I really want to play because I loved I Am Setsuna, my number 5 game of the year from 2016. So I want to play that. It's 4 days later. I don't know if I can beat Digimon in 4 days.
I'm going to guess no.
Well, so
based
we'll
on the first one. You're not doing that.
On January 26th, just 3 days after that, Dragon Ball FighterZ is coming out.
That's
and
right.
You and I both want to play the shit out of that.
Because
it looks amazing.
Yeah.
So that's 3 days after that. On the same day as Dragon Ball FighterZ, Monster Hunter World.
The first
console Monster Hunter game in forever, which also looks pretty cool, is coming out.
Shit.
And Jesus 4 days
Christ.
After that, this isn't a game I really care about, but just worth noting, Dissidia Final Fantasy NT, which is like a weird Final Fantasy knockoff thing, but it's also a significant Japanese game, is coming out. So that is between the 19th and the 30th, you have 6 major Japanese releases, 4 of which are giant JRPGs, one of which is the new Dragon Ball game, which I feel like should be coming out in like March or the fall or some
sure.
big period, because Dragon Ball games do well, especially nowadays, but like... Or not especially, but just like the Xenoverse games kind of brought them back.
Yeah.
So anyway, yeah. That's nuts. How just fuck that.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
I want to play at least 4 of those games. Like Digimon Story 2, Ni no Kuni 2, Lost Sphere, and Dragon Ball FighterZ were all on my list. And they didn't all have dates, and then they like all got dated, and it's like, well, fuck.
Yeah, like for me, it is like I really want to play those 4. Like I can like kind of... I can safely say, like, Ni no Kuni 2 is something I can put off. Like, Digimon
sure.
Story definitely takes priority. But Dragon Ball FighterZ and Monster Hunter World, that's fucking hard. Like, that's a hard matchup to sort of resolve for me.
I mean, I think you and I are both contractually obligated. We'll be playing Digimon Story 2 on release day.
We have to, yeah.
And talking about it.
It would be a crime against ourselves and our listeners not to.
Yeah, so we'll talk about that. And I'm gonna get Dragon Ball, and I'm gonna get Lost Sphere... At least Dragon Ball is a fighting game and I don't have to, like, you know, play 60 hours of it. But it's like, that is a brutal month.
Yeah.
What the fuck, Japan? What the hell? Because, again, I just think it's hilarious. Not a one of those is an American game.
Yeah.
I mean, Dragon Ball, I think, was developed by, like, an American studio, wasn't it?
No.
Is that Japanese studio?
Yeah, I can't remember what the name is of the studio. But it's the
Arc System Works. That is Japan.
Yeah,
okay.
Arc. Yeah, that's definitely Japanese.
But yeah, so these are all Japanese. It's nuts. And Monster Hunter World looked cool.
It looks very cool. And, like, I've always wanted to play a Monster Hunter game, and it's always been a thing of, like, I don't want to play a Monster Hunter game on handheld, so that's never going to be a thing for me. And then they're like, oh, hey, here's one that's not... There's the one that we made for you.
All right, well...
Now, it also has a grappling hook in it, so it's like, I'm also way into grappling hooks. I'm into hunting monsters. I'm into worlds in general.
You're into monsters, huntings, worlds.
Yeah, it's just all, it's like, hey, this is another instance where we made the video game for you, Sean. We did it.
Yeah.
It's like, thank you. Unfortunately, I might not be able to play it in time.
Some of these are slightly multi-platform, like Lost Sphere, you can get on Switch. Digimon Story 2 will also be on Vita, I assume with crossplay. But I also love, all 6 of those are PS4 games.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, like, I would, when I can play a game on Switch, I tend to buy it there. But, like, if obviously you just have a PS4, also, it's like your PS4 is going to be just filling up that month.
Yeah.
Anyway, biggest gaming news of the week, though, probably, is that EA, which we talked about a lot last time.
Oh, yeah.
Is buying Respawn, the developers
right.
of Titanfall, made from... that development team is the a lot of the people who were fired from Infinity Ward back
yeah.
in the day. They have bought Respawn for $400 million. This deal includes developing Titanfall 3... but also a new Star Wars game, to which I wrote in my outline, haha, lols, good luck with that.
Yeah, I mean, that's we've known about that Star Wars game for a year or two.
We did? Okay.
Yes, because that's the one where Stig Asmussen, who was the project lead on God of War 3, is developing it. Okay. So we saw a clip of him standing in a motion capture room with a dude in a motion capture suit at, like, E3 last year, or maybe 2 years ago, saying, like, we're making a Star Wars video game, and like, next to seeing a GIF of the Star Wars video game that Visceral was making that no longer exists, that's the only time we've seen that game, but yes, we have known that that's in development.
Okay, I look forward to both that Star Wars game and that Titanfall game having to switch development to the Frostbite engine, and then the entire studio being shuttered in the year 2020.
Oh my, what if they really do make Respawn make Titanfall 3 on Frostbite? What if they are actually that fucking stupid that they've already made two Titanfall games on their own engine?
I mean, they might. At least it's an FPS.
Yeah. Sure. Yes. At least it's the closest one to actually like the kind of game that that engine was made for.
I mean, just a quick background on this. EA had published Titanfall 1 and 2, and so they had right of first refusal. Respawn was searching for a buyer. There was a company in Europe, I believe, that was looking to buy them. But EA, again, had right of first refusal, and they offered $400 million. Totally makes sense. Like, Respawn at EA makes sense. And yet, coming on the heels of the Visceral thing, one, the Visceral thing actually makes a little more sense if this was in the works.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
But also, like, oh, Respawn, I hope you're okay.
Yeah, I hope that in the episode of this podcast 5 years from now, we're not being like, oh, yeah, like, shit, Respawn just got shut down. Remember that when we talked about them getting bought?
Yeah, I mean, you know, and the Respawn guys, I feel like, should have the requisite PTSD from that kind of thing with Activision, what happened there.
Yeah.
But who knows? I mean, you know, I assume they had some of these details ironed out, like if they do have to move Titanfall 3 to Frostbite or something stupid like that. They probably knew that before they signed the paperwork.
Yeah.
But I don't know. One, are you at all surprised Titanfall 3 is in development? Because Titanfall 2 had such issues.
I feel like it was something that EA basically said that was like, Titanfall 2 did not sell as well as Titanfall 1, but like sold well enough that they're like, we're going to keep on investing in this franchise. Like it seemed like it was just on that like line.
Yeah.
So like I think they have basically intimated that there was going to be another Titanfall game.
Yeah, which I mean, it makes sense. I think the biggest issue with Titanfall 2's sales and launches, it came out in between like 7 other FPSs.
Yeah, the fall last year was just a disaster. No. It was just a killing zone. Like it was like that and Dishonored 2 and a couple of other games that just like came out and was like, nope, you're not going to sell anything.
You know, I think if they can get Titanfall 3 out in like the summer or something and like not put it on the fall death march, it could do well.
I mean, if I remember correctly, Titanfall 1 came out in spring, didn't it? So it's like,
yes,
I feel like that was like a good spot for that game and not having directly compete with Call of Duty like it did last year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we'll see. Bigger question, do you think, I had not thought Respawn was necessarily big enough to do both a Titanfall game and a Star Wars game at the same time. That doesn't always go well.
Yeah.
I'm curious to see what happens.
I'm wondering how much of that is like factors into them wanting to be bought by someone.
Yeah.
Is that they would have like expanded to accommodate the second project, the Star Wars project. And then it was like, well, we, you know, that's expensive.
Yeah.
Well,
hey,
people.
Hopefully third time is the charm. And after Star Wars has killed two development studios, LucasArts and Visceral Games, Respawn will be the one to rise from the ashes. I'm planting the flag, though. It is totally possible that 2 years from now, Respawn gets shut down because their Star Wars project isn't going well.
Yes, yeah. I would not be surprised, unfortunately, were that the case.
Any other reactions to this?
I liked God of War 3. I would like that dude to make a good Star Wars game.
Do you get to throw a giant hammer and like rip people in half in this Star Wars game?
We haven't seen it yet, so hopefully.
All right, so Sean, you want to talk some movie news?
What's going on in movie news, Jonathan?
All right, I'm actually going to save the fun one for last, even though that's out of chronological order. But let's start with a crazy one. The Walt Disney Company has been in talks over the last year, off and on. We're in an off period, apparently, but, you know, it's like Ross and Rachel on Friends. They're always going to get back together. To buy 21st Century Fox, which is the entertainment division of Fox. So, like, they wouldn't be getting Fox News, but they would be getting the 20th Century Fox studio and all its assets, including they would have full rights to the original Star Wars trilogy, particularly New Hope is the one Fox owns. They would have full rights to the X-Men.
Yeah.
and other things.
And Fantastic Four as
Fantastic
well, right?
Four. Yeah. So it seems like this would absolutely be in Disney's interest.
Sure, yeah.
It also seems like, you know, we've known for a while Fox is maybe trying to go in a different direction with some of this. And, you know, 20th Century Fox has not had the biggest hits over the last few years. They've, like, with some of the X-Men, like, spin-off movies like Logan and Deadpool kind of getting better, and we'll see how that goes. And I think they're probably waiting to see how the next round of X-Men movies goes or something.
Yeah. But it's like, crazy that we can still say the next round. It's not the next X-Men movie. It is, like, they've got three, right?
Uh-huh.
They've got the next, like, mainline X-Men movie with the Dark Phoenix. They've got the New Mutants, the trailer of which I saw again in front of Thor Ragnarok. And was, like, again, like, this is such a weird fucking trailer for a comic book movie. And they've got Deadpool 2. That's insane.
It is. So, Sean, I mean, like, I feel like Disney buying 20th Century Fox is the joke you make nowadays because Disney owns so much stuff.
Yeah. No, it's legitimately kind of terrifying to me of like, it goes, yeah, it definitely, it starts going beyond the point of, like, haha, like, Disney's becoming this massive conglomerate, and it's like, oh, God, Disney is buying every fucking entertainment company on the planet.
And the thing is, Disney's a weird conglomerate. It's not like Warner Brothers, which is also Time Warner, and Time Warner is merging with AT&T.
Right.
And that kind of stuff, I think, is much, much, much more harmful to, like, society in that we should just be enforcing antitrust laws to stop giant mergers like that. Disney does not reach out really beyond entertainment. Like, they don't own telephone lines or anything. But they are getting to a point where they already have a, like, for the foreseeable future, Disney will have the top grossing movies of every year going forward.
Mm-hmm.
And, oh, the other thing they would get with this is Avatar 2, 3, 4, 5. So, keep that in mind. Which I think, honestly, Disney might just cancel, but we'd see about that.
If they bought Fox, they would absolutely cancel those fucking sequels. There's no world in which Disney would go for a project that risky, I think.
I mean, that has to be one of the biggest sticking points in this negotiation, I would feel like.
Yeah.
Because they're, I mean, Fox is being ready to pour a full $1 billion into this.
Yeah.
Who knows? Anyway. But yeah, I mean, it's like, it's hard to you can't define, like, the monopolistic side of Disney as cleanly as you can, like, a Time Warner or something. But you can't just, like, they're getting to a point where they're going to own, like, every weekend at the box office because they just have that many. They have all the big franchises.
Yeah, it's not that, you're like, it's not that insidious kind of monopoly where it's like, oh, we kind of could have a finger in every one of the pies. Like, we kind of control everything along this whole chain of industry. It's more just,
it's not like they own the movie theaters.
Exactly, yeah. But they're just amassing such an insane wealth of power and influence and money in this very specific spot that makes it feel like the opening lines to a, like, cyberpunk Blade Runner-esque movie of, like, Disney bought 20th Century Fox and began the era of mega corporations. It's like, it's not a monopoly, it's just a mega corporation that owns everything about this, like, one very specific thing. It's every single year, all the top grossing movies, all the best regarded movies, there will be, like, 20 years from now, every single movie at the Oscars will be a Disney movie. It's not that Disney owns the Oscars, it's just that Disney is the only company making movies anymore.
It is a crazy thing, at least on that, like, big blockbuster stage, because Disney doesn't even really get that much into, like, prestige stuff or smaller releases.
Not yet.
Who knows? But, like, it is crazy. Like, they are already kind of own that space. Just Star Wars and Marvel are powerful enough for that. And then, of course, their own animated projects and all that, and their live
Pixar,
action remakes and stuff. And
yeah,
they have, I forget about Pixar. Pixar's kind of forgettable these days. But, like, yeah, it's nuts. And the Fox stuff, like, I just want to know how Marvel would even take all that in. Like, I feel like Kevin Feige would be like, they can keep it. You know what?
Yeah.
We're okay. We'll take Doctor Doom.
Yeah, we'll take Hugh Jackman. I don't know if he's still playing Wolverine, but we will take Hugh Jackman.
He can play whoever he wants.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, it's like, because I think X-Men would be kind of impossible to work into the MCU.
Yeah, I would be way more interested in them, like, incorporating Fantastic Four in some way and bringing them into the Marvel Universe than trying to deal with the fucking X-Men question.
Right. Of course, there's also the issue of the Earth might be really salted with Fantastic Four at the moment.
That's true.
So we'll see. But yeah, I mean, look, this would 100% be to Disney's benefit. Like, all these things that are, like, kind of related to their franchises, like Star Wars and some of these extra Marvel properties and stuff, they want to own, obviously.
Yeah.
And, you know, selfishly, I see that and I'm like, they would finally have an opening to do the unaltered versions of the original Star Wars films on Blu-ray. Maybe, hopefully, please.
Yeah.
But, you know, we'll see. It's It's interesting. I'm curious to see where this goes. Apparently, like, there's been a lot of reports that, like, the Talks are dead. No, they're still alive. I think once you start down this path, typically you keep going on it, is what I see in the news, but we'll see.
It makes you wonder if, like, back when they got that deal with Sony to make Spider-Man Homecoming, all that stuff, if, like, behind the scenes of that, they were like, let us make this movie, give us Spider-Man, or we will fucking own you. Like, we're just going to own you. Like, give us Spider-Man, or you're fucked. It's like, okay, we'll give you Spider-Man, Jesus Christ. I wonder if, like, this will be, like, give us Dr. Doom, and give us Hugh Jackman, or we will fucking put you in the ground.
I'm imagining Mickey Mouse himself doing that, yes, in the meeting.
Yeah.
We will put you in the ground! Ho-ho!
Yes.
All right. Speaking of Disney and Star Wars, big news out of Star Wars this week, which is that Rian Johnson, the director of the upcoming Star Wars The Last Jedi, is developing a new Star Wars trilogy for Disney. He is writing and directing the first film, producing with Ram Bergman, who is his longtime producer. And I actually didn't even know this. Ram Bergman is the co-producer on The Last Jedi, which actually kind of speaks to the amount of power Rian Johnson had on that movie.
Right.
Because I think J.J. Abrams got a producer credit on that one, but he was the director for his movie. So that's, anyway, kind of interesting. We don't have news beyond that, other than this is an indication that Disney and Kathleen Kennedy and everyone at Lucasfilm clearly really like The Last Jedi.
Yeah.
It also kind of tells us, oh, that's why Rian Johnson didn't do Episode 9. And to me, we also know they did confirm, like, one detail. This is not a mainline, like, episodes. This is not more Skywalkers.
Yeah.
And to me, that's the most exciting thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Is Rian Johnson is an immense talent. Last Jedi is, I mean, this kind of confirms that movie's probably going to be really good.
Yeah.
And him getting to play in the Star Wars sandbox without coloring inside the Skywalker family lines, that's exciting.
Yes, it's like basically kind of, I'm looking at that, it's like, you should have just done that in the first place. Like, that's just like, let's like, yeah, I want the new shit.
Yeah.
And it seems like he's the dude to get to make the new shit.
It's kind of the first time in this new Star Wars cycle of movies, whether it's the episodes or the spin-offs, where we've had a big project announced without immediately linking it to, like, oh, this is the Han Solo movie,
right,
or this is the Death Star movie, or this is Episode 7, and it's the sequel to Return of the Jedi. And that's exciting. And it sounds like Rian Johnson kind of did a good enough job with The Last Jedi that he's bought himself creative freedom in the Star Wars universe.
Yeah.
And that's exciting. Unless, like, they announced this is the Boba Fett trilogy. And it's like, okay, fuck off with that.
Fuck, that would be so terrible. No, this is the Jabba the Hutt trilogy. That's really where we're going.
You know what? It's Space Hobbit. It's The Hobbit, but it's three movies, and it's in space.
Yes. We just bought the rights to The Hobbit movies, and we just, like, sort of, every time there's a sword, we just made it a lightsaber and put the sound effect over it.
I'd watch that. Anyway, no, but I think it's cool, and I am more excited than ever for Last Jedi, because again, it kind of confirms that everything I've been hearing and people have been reporting that, like, this isn't just a good Star Wars movie, but kind of a different one. It's not just playing again within the lines that we've kind of seen. And I am so curious to see, like, what about this movie is so good that they're going all in on Rian Johnson?
Yeah.
And I've been following Rian Johnson's work for years. I love his early movies like The Brothers Bloom, later Looper. His work on Breaking Bad was outstanding.
Yeah.
You know, so I just think it's cool that he seems like a nice guy rising through the ranks on sheer talent, not just because he's a dick or something, which we get a lot of.
It also was like one of those of, like, I saw, you know, like on Twitter or something, like, oh, like Lucasfilm, like, announcing something. I'm like, oh God, what happened this time on a Star Wars movie? And it's like, oh no, it is just, they're like, we're giving the dude who has had no problems making a Star Wars movie more Star Wars movies. Like, that seems like a smart choice, guys.
That's how it usually goes.
Yeah, good on you.
Yeah, no, that seems good. And that also, to me, kind of indicates that they're thinking long-term, like, after Episode 9, they're not just going to immediately do Episode 10. Like, maybe they're going to take a time off from, like, you know, again, the kind of Skywalker family saga and all that. So, which I say, who knows, we're going to find out in this next movie if Rey is actually a Skywalker and how closely those are tied, but anyway. So that's fun. That looks cool. I had the note here about, just to reiterate, Gal Gadot refusing to return as Wonder Woman until they kick Brett Ratner to the curb. You go, girl.
Yeah.
Anyway. Or as my favorite pun on Twitter was, you go, gal.
Don't say that. Don't say that.
All right. Sean.
Yeah.
After the failure of Universal's The Mummy this summer, the Dark Universe has more or less been abandoned, and the best detail of this story, I think it was The Hollywood Reporter published this, that there was an office, like a floor at the office building of Universal, where like the producers were planning the Dark Universe, that has been vacated, the offices are empty, the producers have left for other projects, including Alex Kurtzman, who was going to be like their golden boy, but because he's a talentless hack, it didn't really work out. They were planning another movie called Bride of Frankenstein that was right. going to have been directed by Bill Condon, who's a pretty big director. I mean, this year did Beauty and the Beast, which is the highest grossing film of the year so far, and other than Star Wars, probably will be. So that's kind of a big one to just leave on the shelf. But yeah, like, I just love the image of, like, the offices are empty, and no one at Universal... Like, it's not that Universal canceled it, it's that literally there's no one left working on it, because they had... Do you remember they had a whole cast announcement?
Yeah, they had their whole crazy fucking, like, three paragraphs they put out that I read on the podcast about, like, the weird consortium with led by fucking, like, Dr. Jekyll and all this shit played by Russell Crowe.
This really feels like... the absolute, like, nadir of the shared universe bullshit, where, like, you know, WB bungled it pretty badly with the Justice League stuff.
But they're still trying, like, it was, but, like, those movies still made money, so yeah, it's like, even if everyone hated them, they made enough money that's like, well, we can still kind of try to salvage this together, and then Wonder Woman came out, it's like, well, everyone likes this one, so there's, like, a hope. There. Yeah.
Well, and I was going to say, Justice League actually got made. Like, they did all these premature casting announcements, but they did eventually do something with it, even if it seems very kind of in shambles, they did it. With this, like, they did all their big casting before they had any writers and directors and all this shit, and then they had this one shitty mummy movie that I feel like everyone should have been able to see a mile away was not going to be good, and that's it. Goodbye. Like, that just feels like that's pretty much it for these bad shared universes.
It is just like the most... It's just the most predictable thing that could have possibly happened to this fucking movie. It probably is... We probably literally said that this would happen on the podcast when we talked about it. Because it's so... It was such a fucking terrible idea. It's such a just fucking insane... It's an insane thing to try to do of, like, let's bring all these, like, not even ever, like, originally connected stories, like, you know, that are, like, these, like, vaguely Victorian Gothic, like, horror novels and stuff, and try to sort of, like, piece together a connective tissue behind them that was never supposed to be there. And then I'm just bringing up the image from the Variety magazine of Javier Bardem and Angelina Jolie and fucking Tom Cruise... and Russell Crowe, and all these people that are like...
Johnny Depp was in there too,
yes,
right?
Yes, Johnny Depp is the other one. All standing with, like, wearing black clothes in front of a black screen, I think Johnny Depp is the one that's sitting... No, Javier Bardem is, like, sort of sitting down in a chair, all casual, looking all cool. Which is, like, that's the one tragedy is I really want him to play the Frankenstein's monster, which is what he was going to be cast as. That's a great casting. But other than that, like... This is one for the fucking, like, the weird, like, did you know corner of, like, your film history 10-10 textbook. It's like, did you know, like, in the history of cinematic universes, they were going to make the Dark Universe. Here's this picture of all the people they were going to cast in it. Only two of these people ever fucking were in a movie in this universe. Because after that movie, they fucking, nope. Also, Tom Cruise wasn't the mummy. So, like, I don't know why, like, the mummy wasn't even a part of their shared universe. It was just Tom Cruise.
So bizarre. So stupid. It's like, and I just love how everyone learned the wrong lesson from Marvel.
Yeah.
Like, when Marvel made Iron Man, they did not simultaneously announce every other movie. They kind of indicated they had plans, but they didn't, like, firmly announce them, give dates, and then, like, just cast Thor, Cap, and Hulk, like, off the bat. And then be like, and we're going to make Avengers.
Yeah, and like put out this huge press release and this statement and all these photos and shit.
It's just the height of hubris. You are inviting failure when you do that. And also, like, did no one watch The Mummy? Like, that was so manifestly, obviously a bad movie. Did no one at Universal take a look and be like, oh, right, Alex Kurtzman can't direct his way out of a paper bag. Fuck. Fuck. Yeah.
Guys, we have to can the Dark Universe. It's not going to work. I just watched The Mummy. It's done. It was never a good idea to begin with.
The only movie out of this I really want is like a screwball comedy about the making of the Dark Universe.
Sure, yeah.
Where you just get a bunch of comedians together to play like these idiots trying to make a universe and it never happens.
Yeah.
Anyway, speaking of things that might be the height of hubris, Amazon Studios, we're moving to TV news.
Oh, right.
Has acquired the rights to The Lord of the Rings in a deal with the Tolkien Estate and Warner Brothers in conjunction with New Line. They have already committed to a multi-season deal for a Lord of the Rings series. Now, before this was formally announced, it kind of sounded like they were going to be redoing the books. The Hollywood Reporter story from today has this quote, Amazon's Lord of the Rings series will be set in Middle-earth and explore new storylines preceding Tolkien's The Fellowship of the Ring. The deal includes a potential additional spin-off series. What this report does not have is a writer attached. Any talent, anything. It's just they're going to make it, and they've committed to multiple seasons, and they've spent a lot of money. They have absolutely no one who's actually pitched an idea on what to do. It's just, we have Lord of the Rings, we'll figure it out later.
They did take a picture of Javier Bardem wearing a suit and attached it to the article, though.
As a hobbit.
Yes, just there.
Sean, that's a thing.
It's something of, like, it's so, like, this news was so recent, I still kind of, like, don't really believe that it's happening. It's, like, in the stage of, like, they have, like, it probably is happening, like, based on this stuff, but, like...
Oh, Amazon spent the money.
Yes, exactly. Because they spent the money, it's probably happening. But because there's, like, it's so abstract still, I'm like, nah.
Yeah.
Now, in my heart of hearts, I still can't believe it. I mean, at least they're not trying to do the books, because that would be so foolhardy and insane.
It's just like, they're some of the greatest movies ever, and no matter how high budget your TV series is, they're just never going to compare.
Yeah, and I just think, like, so many of those performances in particular were so, like, iconic, like, the music is so iconic, I think it'd be very hard to make room for in that, like, world visually for people that's not just the Peter Jackson version of it.
Now, what do you think about my suggestion on Twitter that instead it's a prequel, we get a 7-season Hobbit adaptation?
I mean, you know, there's, I think if you really read between the lines, I think there's a lot of space in there.
I think the end of season one, I'm assuming these are all 13 episode seasons, the season finale, season one, we get to the trolls from chapter two. Season five can be a 13 episode flashback to Smaug's backstory, you know, and then we can get the spinoff Better Call Smaug. You know, there's a lot we could do here.
I'm more fixated on the idea of it being like a, like, weird adaptation of the Silmarillion, and it's like, it's like season one is they're still in the shit of, like, the gods creating Middle Earth, and then, like, you're like, okay, by the end of season one we'll be moving on to, like, that's done and, like, all the cool shit, and then season two they're still creating the Earth, and it's like you realize that, like, it's this Mobius loop of a story where it's like, I still have the standing theory that no human being has ever actually been able to read all the Silmarillion and retain the information, that even if you do it, like, you have blocked some part of it out because it's a book that's impossible to hold contiguously in yourself at any point, like, single point.
Wasn't that the Doctor Who episode this year, Extremis, like, the book that would kill you or something?
Sure, it's almost like that. It's almost like that. That, like, you can't get to the end of it. It never fucking happens. Like, I'm a massive Lord of the Rings fan. I have never managed to read all of the Silmarillion from, like, from cover to cover. I have read most of the Silmarillion, probably, because eventually at some point I skip to the parts that are more interesting. But, like, that book is crazy, and I would love to see somebody try to adapt that, because it's, like, people always said before the Peter Jackson stuff that, oh, Lord of the Rings, that's unadaptable. Like, it's too big, it's too, like, you can't make it to a movie. It's like Watchmen and, like, that kind of stuff. It'll never happen. It's like, those people never fucking even tried to read the Silmarillion, because that's a book that's impossible to adapt into a movie.
The thing is, if they had announced this with, like, an interesting writer, an interesting team that had some interesting pitch of, like, this is the area of the universe we're going to explore, this is, like, our main character, something like that, I think there's plenty of room within Middle-earth to do a cool TV series.
Oh, yeah.
But my suspicion, like, 90% suspicion, is that this will be warmed over retreads a la Shadow of Mordor.
Yes. I mean, my suspicion is, hey, Game of Thrones is ending.
So here's the thing. This is why, and my the transition I forgot to make but was going to is, like, I was saying everyone's learned the wrong lessons from Marvel. It is also abundantly clear that absolutely everyone has learned the wrong lessons from Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
Because everyone's scrambling to, like, buy some fantasy property. And it's like, you guys know the next Game of Thrones isn't just going to be a fantasy book. That's not how that works.
Yeah.
Like, HBO's biggest hit before Game of Thrones was The Sopranos. They're not the same thing. Like, they didn't like make Game of Thrones by being like, get me the next Sopranos. That's right. You would never get to Game of Thrones that way. So it's like, it's, you know, like, and everyone's doing this. Netflix has bought the rights to the Witcher books, which I actually think if you have the right people doing it, could be a great TV series.
Yeah.
It would never be a hit like Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
And that's also not what they're going to do. It's going to be bad, probably. But, like, you know, it's going to be twice the length it needs to be. It's a Netflix show. Anyway. But, like, yeah, it's just, that's not how you're going to make a hit. And that Lord of the Rings show would have to be really fucking good to actually get people to watch it. Because that's the thing is, like, brand name recognition isn't enough.
Yeah.
And I think actually there's stuff like Star Trek Discovery right now that shows that. I'm not watching that.
Me neither, yeah.
And I think a lot of Star Trek fans aren't, because the, like, most positive reaction I've heard is,
it's not as bad as you think it is. Is mostly the log line I've heard from that movie.
And
or that show.
That show. And yeah. That's the thing. And it's not, like, the level of hit you would think it would be just on easy brand recognition. That's not how this works. Like, Game of Thrones actually was not a huge brand before the TV series. It was a series of books that was successful with, like, a big cult following, but it entered the mainstream after that. Lord of the Rings is already firmly in the mainstream. And so if you were to do something, like, I think if you were actually to make a good Lord of the Rings show, it would be really niche for, like, book readers.
Right.
If you're to make a big tent Game of Thrones show, it's probably just going to be boring and dull and a ripoff of Game of Thrones, and no one's actually going to stick around past season one. So,
because also, like, you know, granted, like, I don't have a huge amount of firsthand experience of Game of Thrones, but it's so part of the cultural zeitgeist that it's, like, hard not to have a basic familiarity with it. Is my basic impression is that as far as fantasy goes, Lord of the Rings and Game of Thrones are basically, like, antithetical. Like, they're on the exact opposite side of the fucking spectrum, right? In terms of, like, basic worldview and, like, tone.
Oh, sure, yeah. I mean, you know, there's some, I mean, obviously, it's a weird thing where Game of Thrones' visual language is inspired by Peter Jackson's Lord of the Rings, because it has to be.
And Sean Bean was in it.
And just, like, that's, like, Peter Jackson laid down a 21st century blueprint for how fantasy looks on screen. And, I mean, like, The Witcher, the games are inspired by how Lord of the Rings looks on screen. It's just, it's kind of like how fantasy space movies look like Star Wars or something. But no, actually, if you look at the texts, yes, they are very, very different. They're both very, like, rich, like, you know, tangible worlds, but Game of Thrones is not really about magic, it's about political intrigue. Lord of the Rings is about much smaller people, literally hobbits, like, you know, on more grand, like, almost allegorical adventures, you know. It's a very different kind of thing.
Yeah. So I think, like, if you're trying to, like, I just think, like, and it's one of the things that the fucking Shadow of Mordor or Middle-Earth games, or whatever the fuck you call both of them. I guess you call them the Middle-Earth games, even though that's a weird way to refer to them.
The Shadow of Games.
The Shadow of Games. It like, go for more of that, like, dark fantasy, weird shit that's, like, not quite Lord of the Rings. And anyone who's a Lord of the Rings fan and plays those games is, like, you can maybe kind of enjoy Shadow of Mordor even if you're a Lord of the Rings fan, but it's despite of the fact that you're a fan of Lord of the Rings. Not in any way because of it.
No, yeah.
Because it's more chasing that dark fantasy idea.
Yeah, it's, I have, like, very little faith in this, especially when you announce without a writer. Like, then whoever actually comes in is in just the worst possible position. This kind of thing doesn't work. So, we'll see. Another series at the works at a streaming service, this one was announced earlier today in Variety or something, Hitman, which has had two bad movies that no one saw. And I actually saw the first one, but no one saw either of them. A Hitman series is in the works at Hulu. However, it is from the mind of John Wick writer Derek Kolstad, who, I will say, if you had to pick anyone on Earth without actual credentials to make a Hitman adaptation, that's, like, the one guy.
Yeah.
Because John Wick is pretty much a Hitman movie.
If like, it's a Hitman movie if it was your Hitman, Jonathan. Let's make that clear. Of, like, if it was my Hitman movie, it would be a guy, like, very methodically going through and, like, putting poison in someone's drink and, like, reloading a save 5 times to make sure that, like, the guard patterns are perfect and, like, leaving a gun in the right spot so the guard moves over here. If it's your Hitman movie, it's someone just, like, running through the streets, shooting everybody in the head, which is, like, John Wick.
But all I'll say is that John Wick has that super cool, like, mythology.
Yeah, and it has, and yeah, funny. The weird, like, world with, like, everyone with the gold coins and all that shit is very Hitman-y.
And, like, the way it uses Keanu Reeves, like, that's the kind of actor, frankly, you would need for an Agent 47, where it's like, you're kind of stoic, but you get a lot of kind of humor out of it. Like, that's the thing. I have never been convinced Hitman could work outside of the confines of a game, except, you know, we've talked about, like, there's a lot of weird scenarios you get into, like, playing especially the most recent Hitman game, where it's like, you could make a fun movie thing out of
this. Yeah, there have definitely been a couple of hits I've done in that game where, like, particularly some of the, like, more scripted hits where I'm like, this would make a fucking badass movie. Like this, like, whole plot line and doing all this stuff. This would be awesome.
And here's why it's important to announce a writer with things, is that the Amazon Lord of the Rings things, I actively dread that. If this actually gets made at Hulu with Derek Kolstad and they announce some cool casting, I'd totally watch that.
Sure.
That sounds fun. And that's why you should announce a writer with your project, for fuck's sake.
Yeah, exactly. Because if the news was just Hulu is going to make a Hitman TV show, you're just like...
I'd roll my eyes.
Yeah, like, sure you are. Yeah, great. Yeah. Great idea. Nobody tried to do that before.
And the official Hitman Twitter actually tweeted this out. They seemed kind of excited. Yeah. So, you know, I think if it had a John Wick-esque tone, maybe with... you know, a mix of, like, body count, but also more stealthy stuff. Yeah. You know, it could be fun. And Hitman also, I don't think, needs, like, a big movie budget. I actually think that gets in the way of the Hitman movies, is, like, you have to hit certain boxes when you're doing a movie. But with TV, like, just have fun with it. Like, he does different hits every week or something. Yeah. Anyway. I saved the best news for last, even though it's, like, a week old. And that is that the BBC did release a promo picture of Jodie Whittaker as the 13th Doctor. And we have a picture of the 13th Doctor in her costume.
Yep.
And it's a silly costume again.
Yep. Suspenders, motherfucker.
Yellow suspenders. Blue pants pulled up very high. The shirt has a rainbow on it. She's got like a big trench coat, which is awesome. And those boots are really cool. And her socks are blue.
Yes, she has TARDIS blue socks.
The
TARDIS model is also subtly different in some specific ways.
Yes.
It's very like third, fourth Doctor-y looking to me. Like, it's got the black panel, and it's got like more grain to it and stuff. So that's cool. That's the kind of thing you're never fucking ever going to notice. But it's, you know, they like to change the TARDIS model up every now and then just because, you know, you can. But yeah, the costume is great. I love it. I think it's just like, it's funky in the right kind of way. It feels like... If like the sort of John Nathan Turner era, like 5th, 6th, 7th Doctor costumes, if they weren't quite as asinine.
That was my first reaction. Like, this is actually a kind of toned down, like, this looks like something someone would actually wear.
Yeah.
And it feels like that. It feels 5th, 6th, 7th Doctor.
Yeah, it's just like the right kind of like retro funky sort of thing without going so far as to just slap a bunch of question marks on her. Which, there's a part of me that would be kind of into that, but don't ever do it again. Just don't ever do it again.
We, you know, there's a time and place for everything.
Yeah. I think the one thing, they, if they wanted to, because she does, another detail is she does have earrings. If they wanted to...
Didn't notice that.
They could have given her earrings that are like a dangling question marks from one ear or both ears, maybe.
Yes.
If you wanted to bring the question marks back, that's how I'd do it.
Honestly, why I like this costume is my first reaction was kind of a double take, like, that's not a traditional Doctor costume.
Yeah.
And that's probably good, you know? The other thing is I looked at it like, yes, that is the Doctor after, for the first time becoming a woman, I think that's how she would dress herself.
Yeah.
You know, like, it wouldn't just be like, she'd go get a pantsuit or something. I don't know, it looks cool, and I'm very curious, as always, to see what it's like in motion, how it changes week to week.
Yeah, that's the thing I'm most curious about, is if they're going to kind of do the more Peter Capaldi. I guess Matt Smith did it a bit in, like, the latter period of, like, changing the costume up more, like, episode to episode and season to season. Like, keeping it within that same theme, but, like, you know, throwing different interesting bits in there. I like that about the last couple of seasons. I think it'd be cool to keep doing that.
Yeah. Jodie Whittaker, and we've said this every time they've had a promo pic or something of her, she just looks like the Doctor. She just, like, has that, it's like you can't define it, and obviously, like, this is our first female Doctor, so it's a slightly different thing, but when you see someone, like, in that role, and I'll honestly say, like, there have been times where, like, early promo pictures don't look like that. Like, go back and look at Matt Smith's first picture when he was announced.
Right, yeah.
That does not look like the Doctor. It barely looks like Matt Smith. It's a really bizarre promo picture. We haven't had that with Jodie Whittaker. Like, it feels like she has the presence right off the bat.
And it just feels like they've been very smart about how, like, they've revealed it of, like, because, you know, instead of just doing the Matt Smithy thing of, like, it's just like, because the Matt Smith thing looked like the Variety cover for the Dark Universe, you know? It's just like him in, like, a black suit or something. Whereas with the Jodie Whittaker stuff, they had that whole, like, YouTube video with her, like, with, like, the hoodie, like, coming off, that feels like, you know, not a Doctor costume, but a, like, Doctor Who enough looking kind of outfit she was wearing, and that teaser that's like, you can still see her as the character and she doesn't just look like an actress.
They also announced this week that the director for the first block of episodes for the new season, and I forget his name, but he also actually directed that promo spot.
Oh, cool.
With her. Because I think that's just kind of neat, that he directed, like, literally the first footage of her as the Doctor, and he'll be doing... That first block is not the first two episodes, but the first episode is in that block. So anyway, it's just, it's like, I think they're still kind of doing more of a kind of drip-drip of information, because they know, you know, it's not quite time, because Capaldi is still technically the Doctor until Christmas. But I like that, you know, the things we've gotten are all very... I'm just so excited for season 11, for this new era. It's cool.
Yes.
I can't wait for a nice picture of everyone, like, in the TARDIS, in costume. Good sense of what we're going to get. So, I wonder if... Because they're shooting now, and or at least they're at least doing table reads. I wonder if they're going to have footage at Christmas, like any kind of preview. That'd be interesting.
It's definitely possible. I mean, obviously, we will get at least some of her, like, like immediately post-regeneration. And that's, like, the thing I'm most looking forward to. I mean, obviously, it's not the actual thing I'm most looking forward to. But, like, the weird detail I'm really looking forward to for the first episode is having another episode of her in Peter Capaldi's costume.
Oh, I hope
that she's just regenerated from. Because that's always my, like, the best thing about fucking Doctor Generation stories. Especially when you go back and watch them after you've spent, like, seen the whole run. Is like... Holy shit, Sylvester McCoy looks fucking crazy in Call of Fingers outfit. Oh my god, that is so weird to see. Or, like, you know, having Peter Capaldi, like, at the beginning of Deep Breath, wearing the Matt Smith outfit. It's like, what? That's, like, kind of hurts my head a bit.
I always love, it's actually kind of brief in The Christmas Invasion, but I do love Tennant in the leather jacket.
Yeah.
Because that's so just, not a Tenth Doctor
thing.
It's
so huge on him, too, because, like, it already didn't fit Eccleston that well. But, it's like, on Tennant, it's just like, he's such a skinny dude.
Yeah, it's always a fun detail. I hope Capaldi regenerates in the hoodie outfit and everything, just so we can have all of it.
Yeah, like the fingerless gloves and just like the most raggedy fucking 12th Doctor outfit he ever wore.
I'm just so excited for Doctor Who's future.
Yeah.
All right, that's it for this time. We will be back later in the week with episode 214, where we will review Thor Ragnarok, talk about some video games, talk about some other stuff. And I'm glad we got to get all this off of our chest today.
Yes, it's been, you know, a whole spectrum of news. And I'm very glad we got in on Doctor Who, because we need that little spark of hope in our lives.